I'm sure most of you are either my friend on Facebook or know me well enough to kind of know what's been going on in my life recently. It's been a very busy time for me. We just moved into our new home here in Simi, which is pretty exciting, and it was the end to a pretty long and difficult process of selling our old house and buying this new one. And my work has also picked up quite a bit recently into a pretty crazy level, and all the while here, we're having another baby in just a few weeks. So all this stuff was going on recently, but I'm not planning to talk about any of that today, at least not directly. I've been thinking about a topic for the last few days, and it all started when I was checking my Facebook a couple days back on Monday. For those of you who aren't on Facebook or aren't familiar with this feature, they have a feature now where you can click a button, and it will show you all of your Facebook posts from previous years. So it'll say 1 year ago you did this, or you were here, and then 2 years ago, three, four, however long you've been on Facebook, they show you your past basically on that day. And I checked it on Monday, and I found this status that some might remember. It says, "Hey everyone, I'm exhorting from the podium right now, and I'm talking about setting short-term goals every week that you can accomplish and make this week a better week." So that was almost exactly a year ago where I did that fun exhortation where I encourage everyone to update their Facebook status during the exhortation. And it was a fun one to write, and I was a little scared to actually deliver it, but everyone ended up being very accepting and took it all very well. So it was a lot of fun. And just as a quick aside, was anybody else able to maintain their short-term goals past that week? Does anybody remember what they did, what they said they would do, and build on it past that week? No? Okay. Well, bummer. Maybe this week you guys can try it again. Anyway, I pulled up that exhortation to look through it, and I found it kind of funny to remind myself of why I gave that exhortation. For those of you that forgot, I started to set short-term goals for myself because I was having a hard time focusing while I was here at meeting every week. I, had the baby back in the lobby and was making all this noise. I wasn't able to hear what was being said from the podium. And I found this a little funny because at this point in my life, I would love to go back to the point where I just have a baby in a car seat that makes noise every once in a while. A year ago, I was thinking, well, a year from now, he'll be great, and he'll be totally quiet, and sitting through meeting, and everything will be wonderful. And I can see him in the back right now, running around, and it's clearly not been the case. And what I decided to do was write another exhortation to hopefully also help to refocus myself, and also anybody else here who might have a hard time with their spiritual life at times, and also at setting priorities. And as tempting as it was this week, this very busy week, to just redo my exhortation from a year ago and kind of slap a new skin on it, I wanted to frame this one in a very different way. And funnily enough, my inspiration of how to do that came this week when I was driving around my new home here in Simi. Heather and I were driving past the Simi Valley Cultural Arts Center on LA Avenue here, and I remembered what I was doing the last time I was there. I was performing in a rendition of Shakespeare's Much Ado About Nothing for our homeschool group, which was about 10 years ago. And apart from winning a spelling bee once, participating in a Shakespeare play is probably the most homeschoolerish thing I've ever done. And it may sound exciting, but it meant memorizing a lot of very Shakespeare-y lines and all this old English. And for those of you who are familiar with Shakespeare at all or with that play, I was Benedick, which was kind of the male lead, which may sound like a big honor or a big exciting part to get, but it meant even more lines. And I had to kiss this girl, although I actually ended up getting out of that, but I had to at least pretend. And it was a lot of pressure, and it overall wasn't a very enjoyable experience for me. And the worst part for me was the obnoxious instructors we had. And I have a hard time describing them without, sounding mean, but the best way I can say it is they're the kind of people who would willingly teach Shakespeare to homeschoolers, that kind of encapsulates how irritating they would be to a 15-year-old boy. And a lot of these, we had to do a lot of exercises in these classes. A lot of these involved focusing ourselves or finding our center, which I'm sure not quite sure how to do now. We did a lot of exercises where we learned how to hone our acting talents and how to play better with the rest of our group. And a bunch of them were just nonsense to me. However, still 10 years later, I do remember one exercise that really stuck with me through all these years. One day we were all in the middle of a scene and we were reading our lines, and somebody finished their lines and they walked off the stage, and the instructor angrily called a cut. We all looked at him wondering what we did wrong or what we are supposed to fix. And he said, "All right, we're going to have an impromptu exercise. Everyone walk." That's it. That was the exercise. That's all the instruction he gave. We all kind of just stood there awkwardly for a bit, waiting for the next instruction, but he didn't give any. He waited a bit and said, "Just walk." So we all started to slowly walk around the stage. Some of us would, go that way. Some went this way. And some of us kind of went in circles. Some of the more enthusiastic members started to walk in character, and I was like, "Oh, okay, whatever. You do that." I was, I basically started walking in circles myself, and we all awkwardly walked around for a minute or two, and he yelled, "Stop." Now everybody walked to the front door, and we all turned and faced the door and walked confidently towards that front door. I thought he was maybe, letting us out early, so I started to walk, past everybody else. And when we all got to the door, he told us to stop, and he said, "Isn't it so much easier to walk when you know where you're going? Before, when I said to walk, you all looked like you had no idea what you were doing or where you were supposed to go. But when you walk with purpose, the audience believes that you're really on your way to something." And this, of course, to him was, he was just trying to tell us to look like we're on our way to doing something important when we're leaving the scene. We don't want to kind of give our lines and then kind of, slowly walk off the stage. If we're saying in the scene, "I'm about to go talk to, whoever," and then you just go off confidently, it looks like you're really on your way to do something and not just walking past the other side of that curtain. And so I kind of thought about this as a way to kind of frame how we're going to live our lives, and we need to focus on not just our walk to the kingdom, but walking that walk with purpose and conviction, not just walking it slowly and awkwardly and looking for more instruction or direction, but to really, do it with a real purpose. So the Bible has plenty of great examples of how we can walk with a stronger purpose, and also plenty of examples of people that faltered in this and lessons we can learn from that. And we'll start with a good example as we open our Bibles to 2 Corinthians 9. My dad picked some good chapters, and he was close on the 2 Corinthians chapter I would pick, but I found a couple of good ones. So we'll go to 2 Corinthians chapter 9, and we'll start at verse 24. "Do you know that in a race, all the runners run, but only one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain it. Every athlete exercises self-control in all things. They do it to receive a perishable wreath, but we an imperishable. So I do not run aimlessly. I do not box as one beating the air, but I discipline my body and keep it under control, lest after preaching to others, I myself should be disqualified. I love the focus in this passage. This is not telling us to join a race. It's not telling us to walk in a race. It's not telling us to run just to finish or run just to get a consolation prize. It's telling us to run that we may obtain the prize. Only one will receive it. You're being told to run with all of your effort, all of your heart, all of your focus. Another good verse for this, with this type of imagery, is in Hebrews 12, verse 1. Hebrews 12, verse 1. "Therefore, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also lay aside every weight and sin which clings so closely, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us." So this is the same type of language, basically the same type of lesson here, saying, let us run with endurance. Not let us run with grumpiness or run out of obligation, but to run with endurance the race that is set before us. I think it's very, very important to remember this as we now move to a few examples of biblical characters that did not always run with endurance. Of course, the entire Bible is filled with flawed characters, with only one perfect character in the entire book. Just for fun, I Googled the phrase Bible characters who messed up, just to kind of see maybe if anybody had a good, really good example of somebody who made a big mistake. You know, of course, they listed quite a few people. Just about, you know, every major character in the Bible has at least one major recorded flaw or mistake in their character. And, you know, the list starts obviously, you know, Adam and Eve committing the first sin, Cain the first murder, Noah, Abraham, Sarah, Lot, Isaac, Rebecca, Jacob, Rachel, Reuben, and we're not even out of Genesis yet. So it is pretty crazy. Basically, every major character falters in their walk, and they lose sight of, you know, how to walk with a real purpose and following God. You can go to really any of these for an example of somebody who lost their way and started to walk in the wrong direction or walk without a purpose, but are there like one of them in particular, one that was at the end of the list? And my dad actually mentioned it before I came out here. I can't think of any other character that have had so many peaks and valleys in their walk, in their journey, than Peter. Peter is probably one of my favorite characters in the whole Bible, because he'll have moments of such extreme enthusiasm and devotion, with, you know, the biggest swing being his most famous when he tells Christ he loves him three times and then famously denies him three times right after that. And he has moments where he cuts someone's ear off out of enthusiasm, or he'll rebuke people who he thinks are doing wrong, and he gets so caught up in himself that he also makes lots of mistakes along the way, or sometimes his enthusiasm is misplaced. So going with the theme this morning of walking, we'll go to the passage that my dad was mentioning. We'll go to Matthew 14:22. And we're going to read most of this story here, really the whole story of Peter walking to Jesus, because I think it really, for him, encapsulates a journey all on its own of, you know, seeing Jesus, wanting to come to him, going out, failing, and then being rebuked. It's all, it has a great arc to it. So we'll start in verse 22. Immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowd. After he had dismissed them, he went up on a mountainside by himself to pray. Later that night, he was there alone, and the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it. Shortly before dawn, Jesus went out to them, walking on the lake. When the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. "It's a ghost," they said, and cried out in fear. But Jesus immediately said to them, "Take courage. It is I. Don't be afraid." "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you on the water." "Come," he said. And Peter got down out of the boat, walked on the water, and came toward Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid and, beginning to sink, cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately, Jesus reached out his hand and caught him. "You of little faith," he said, "why did you doubt?" And when they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." So you notice here in verse 26, it says that the disciples saw him walking on the lake, and Peter said in verse 28 that he wanted to come to him. In verse 29, he started to come toward Jesus. Now at this point, he's looking at Jesus, and he's walking with purpose towards him. Only we see in verse 30 is when it says that he saw the wind, and he was afraid and began to sink. So only when he took his eyes off of Jesus and looked away from him does he start to falter. I think this is a great lesson for us, that if we look away from our target even for a second, it can be detrimental to our walk, and it can really take away when you start to look at the distractions in the world around you, when you start to see other things maybe you want to walk to instead. I think this is a great lesson that he starts to look away, and the repercussions here are almost instant. And, you know, I think if we had this kind of instant repercussions, if we ever started to falter, we would start to sink, or something bad would start to happen to us, I think it really changed the way that we live. But it can be so tempting to falter or to walk in a different direction because we know that, it might not have any immediate problems and we can fix it later, and we have all these excuses and justifications for ourselves. And the idea of faltering is really a powerful one to me, in that we can't go halfway with things either. I mean, as soon as he saw the wind, he started to have doubts, and that's what messed him up. It isn't that he was, walking for a while. You don't get the vision here that he was walking for an hour and then he started to falter. I mean, it seemed to be a pretty immediate thing. And we cannot go halfway into anything. Please turn with me to Revelations 3:15. Revelations 3:15. I know your works, that you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish you were cold or hot. So then, because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will vomit you out of my mouth. I always find it very interesting that God says he wishes his followers were cold or hot. He would rather we walk one way or the other, as opposed to being lukewarm and pretending to be with him but not really, and be somewhere in the middle. As our Shakespeare, as my Shakespeare instructors would say, they don't want us to walk in place or kind of walk like we don't know where we're going. I mean, he might even say that he'd rather we walk confidently and exit stage left and when it's meant to be stage right. As long as we look like we know where we're going and we do it confidently, he'd probably rather we do that than kind of waver in the middle and not really do anything either way. And this brings me to my last point, which is that I think we need to lead by example. When we were being told by our Shakespeare instructors to walk with purpose, it wasn't because he thought it would be good for our mindset or for our character, but because he wanted it to look good for the audience. He wanted those watching us to really believe that we knew where we were going and what we were doing, and that, it was for their benefit, not really for ours, that they saw us walking with purpose and that they could think, wow, that guy knows where he's going, or he knows what he's, about to do. And it really, it takes them out of the play if we look like we don't really know what we're doing or know where we're going. I think being a parent has really made this a lot more real to me. Even if I'm not 100% confident in what I'm doing all the time, or I know that I make mistakes, I have to remember that there are others watching me. Soon a family of three others will be looking up to me and looking to me to make the right choices and to do it with a real purpose. I know from watching my parents too, they might not have always known exactly what they were doing 100% of the time, because nobody does, but they, to me at least, always seem to have the right mindset and always be walking in the right direction, and that was huge for me. I mean, if they started to walk in the opposite direction, and it would really kind of, mess me up too. So I think that's always a very important thing to think about, in that when you falter, you're not just faltering for yourself. Your faltering can affect other people very, very drastically. So a great verse for this is Titus 2, verse 7. Titus 2, verse 7 says, "Show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, dignity, and sound speech that cannot be condemned, so that an opponent may be put to shame, having nothing evil to say about us." I like how this says to show yourself in all respects to be a model of good works. Not necessarily to be a model of good works all the time, because God knows we're not perfect and that we have moments where we won't be walking with purpose in the way that we are meant to, or we won't be walking at all sometimes. I mean, maybe we'll be walking in the wrong direction, but it's important to still be setting a good example for your family or for the members of your ecclesia, that you show yourself to be a model of good works, if nothing else. I mean, hopefully you will be able to change yourself and to develop your own spiritual mindset well, but it's very important, I think, to at least show yourself to be a model of good works. And I do feel, obviously, that it's important for us to come here and to set an example for our brothers and sisters, and to be here and to remember that we are following the greatest example possible, which is that of Christ, as we come here to remember these emblems. Please turn with me to 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 21. First Peter 2:21. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example, so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. As this passage says, Christ has left an example for us. He has walked his walk with as much purpose as can be possible, and has given us an incredible example to follow. He's left us with this gift, this incredible blessing, to come here and to take the bread and the wine, which is a great way for us to recharge and refocus ourselves and to go back into this week and into this world with the best mindset possible. We can go out those doors today and remember to run our race with endurance, not to be lukewarm, to set a good example, and above all, to walk with a purpose. Thank you.